Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
Oh, what are they, shopping at Costco down in Tuscaloosa, clipping coupons? Come on.
Russ Dellinger.
Spoiler alert, you're going to be sad at the end.
And SI's Pat Forty.
Alaska Fairbanks, national champions in rifle, baby.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod, and I want to start with this. Not really known as a big day in college football calendar, August 15, the Ides of October. The Ides of August.
Oh.
Huh? Bring a little literature in this.
I want, like, is every 15th the Ides? I guess, you know, the Ides of March was Shakespeare's thing, and that was March 15th, so is every 15th the Ides?
It is on this podcast. It is on this
podcast.
There we
go. Ides of July, Ides of June.
I don't know. What is that? Somebody look that up while I babble through this. We're already off the rails. I screwed it up in the first minute. Now we're talking Shakespeare. Okay. Anyway, August 15th, the deadline in the ACC for a school to say, we out. We're leaving in a year. And lot of noise in Tallahassee, but there was no notice of departure given on Tuesday, which was August 15th, perhaps the Ides of August. So as far as we know, the ACC is sticking together for a little bit longer. There is still this big divide where you have four schools that refuse to add Cal, Stanford, perhaps SMU. And then there was this quote the other day from Nebraska AD Trev Alberts, who said on conference realignment to Amy Just of the Lincoln Journal Star, "I don't believe it's done. It's never been done." That's Mark D'Antoni, right? That's Michigan State thing. It's never over. That's a really aggressive quote for a guy sitting there. It's more likely than not there will be continued periods of angst. I believe the next go around, that's my basic conclusion, will be far more disruptive than anything we're currently engaged in. We need to prepare ourselves mentally for that. I'm preparing. I'm preparing mentally. That's such a great, there's just a lot in that quote. This is a real, not, why do I mean, I don't have to prepare. I don't. It's just going to happen. No one's asking me.
You're not waking up in the morning, look at yourself in the mirror and saying, oh man, am I ready for realignment today? I got to get ready.
Mentally preparing for periods of angst. That's just also my general day. All right. Anyway, on to the topic. If the ACC isn't falling apart, at least until next year, do we really still have to prepare? Or are we okay for at least until next August 15th? Pat, what's going on in the ACC and what's going on overall?
First, ancient Roman calendar, the Ides is a day roughly falling in the middle of each month, the 15th day of March, May, July, and October, and the 13th of other months, although it doesn't specify, I mean, I guess all the other months.
Okay.
Anyway, so there's your Ides. Right. I think everyone remains on Seminole watch in the ACC that while this deadline is passed and 2024 will apparently happen with Florida State still a member of the league, there are people saying that they could expect any minute, really any day, for Florida State to issue formal notice and just take a longer runway to 2025 to get out of the league. Somebody said to me, you take 23 months instead of trying to rush it in 11. And, you know, this is not going to be easy. It's going to be super expensive. It's going to be very contentious. Do you have a place to go? There's so many unanswered questions about what this would look like. And so if Florida State is dead set on leaving, are they going to say here this week, next month after that, sometime in the fall, sometime, you know, that, hey, we're out come 2025. And then the fireworks really commence. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are supremely ticked at Florida State, the way they've handled it. Some people are saying, you know, good riddance, will take all the money that it's going to cost them to get out and we'll spread that out amongst each other. And then there are other people like, well, wait a minute. Florida State is a big football brand and we are in a susceptible position here. You pull out one block from the tower and what else comes with it, specifically Clemson. That's the other thing to watch here.
Yeah, Pat nailed it with the timing. I never thought at least that they would do it this year. I think that because that is just so quick, and they've been preparing, I guess, but they've been building up to a potential exit in their comments this past spring and summer. Were pretty obvious that they've been building up for an exit, but it never. Honestly, up until like a day ago when people started writing about it, never even dawned on me that they would do it this year. I always thought it would be, you know, it would be for next year. It would be for the 25 season at earliest, not the 24. So like, you know, ramping up 2 years as opposed to less than a year is certainly more ideal. But there's no doubt based on their comments and other things they've said privately within, I think, the ACC circle, so to speak, that they plan on doing something drastic at some point. There are a lot of questions around what exactly their plans are for the future. Is it, I think Sportico had about a week ago had a story about private equity and FSU using JP Morgan, you know, basically for money, you know, in building up some cash there, which could certainly be a sign that, you know, they plan on some kind of exit that involves using that money, needing that money, which means they don't have a spot to land, which is probably pretty obvious, right? I don't think the Big Ten or SEC, as we've talked on the show before, are going to get involved in a grant of rights legal situation. So does FSU leave and then take a couple years as maybe some kind of independent, or does it leave and maybe then get an invitation to another league? I don't know, but a lot of people have a hard time figuring out what they're going to do because, and if it will be worth whatever they're going to do, if it's worth it in the long run. I think for FSU, it's a long play. You know, it's a 50-year play, not a 5-year play. That's kind of I think how they think of it.
FSU, I think it needs to navigate this well. And I don't know what, I'm not advocating for leaving the ACC or whatever, but it's not located in a major city, has tremendous tradition and has a good television draw and all that. Obviously, its alums and students are all over the state of Florida, but you know, I don't know. It's not Texas. It's not Oklahoma, right? That they always knew there was going to be something for them. There probably is for Florida State, but it's not perfect, right? So what they do and where they go, and I will say they're eighth in the poll, preseason poll. Mike Norvell's got them back, and that could be a good time to try to strike. If you were Florida State, okay, so periods of angst. I'm mentally preparing. I am listening to Trev Albert, and I am mentally preparing here. So if you are Florida State, you need to get out of this thing before anyone wants you. The SEC is very content right now. The Big Ten is not. I think the Big Ten is in panic, a little bit of panic. I think adding Oregon and Washington was a panic move. I'm not sure. They just grabbed them for the sake of grabbing them. It's not that they hurt the league. I just don't know how much they helped the league. And I think they could have got them later, but whatever, they got them. They're coming. But would the Big Ten would probably get them? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe the SEC does it. If you're Florida State, where would you want to go? And who do you think would be more likely to jump at you, SEC or Big Ten? Pat, we'll start with you.
Yeah. You want to go to the SEC because that's your backyard. That's where you recruit. That's where your fans are. But do any of those things even matter anymore? I don't know. I do think the Florida resistance is real and significant. Florida is a major, major player in the SEC and is still the biggest brand from a TV standpoint, et cetera, in the state of Florida. They've underachieved recently in football for sure, but they're not sitting there saying, come on, Florida State, let's be pals here. So there's that. It's a question of, does the SEC want to add another school in a state where they've already got the TV market, so to speak? which is the same issue with Clemson in the state of South Carolina, with another school you've already got there and a school that doesn't want its arch rival in that league. So while that's the geographically advantageous spot, I don't know whether it's the logistically capable spot. And so I think the Big Ten is what you're hoping for. And, you know, there's the same issues there that some other schools are going to face going in the Big Ten. Not as much from a travel standpoint in terms of time zones and that sort of thing, but it ain't easy. And, you know, you're going to get from Tallahassee, which is, you know, not exactly your major airport hub, to Iowa City. Enjoy it. That's great. You want to get from there to Eugene? Go for it. Have fun. So I don't see anything as like this perfect landing spot. Like basically Texas and Oklahoma went to the slam dunk, right? I don't think there's a slam dunk for Florida State or Clemson here.
We talked about it before, but the SEC, there's a lot more attractive teams in the ACC for the SEC. Like Pat said, they already have the state of Florida, they'd already have the state of South Carolina, and so they already get in market rates for TV with TV shares, or and so getting a new state and getting a new in market rate increase in a new state, and I know all that stuff can be complicated. It's just basically more money from TV if you're in a new state. You know, North Carolina and Virginia make a lot of sense as far as getting in those states more than it would getting another school in Florida and another school in South Carolina. I would think, like Pat said, I would think Florida State would prefer the SEC given geographic and cultural the situation. But yeah, there might be more of a chance that it's Big Ten if the Big Ten moves south. You know, we've seen the Big Ten move west. We've seen the Big Ten move east. When will the Big Ten go south, or will it ever go south? I don't know, but certainly the SEC, I think, would probably, even though it's content right now, and it might remain that way for a while, if it does look to expand, I mean, the more valuable teams out there for it, you know, Florida State and Clemson probably aren't necessarily one and two. They might be like four and five or something, but they're probably not one, two.
Yeah, I agree. I think Notre Dame's number one draft pick for everybody. Mm-hmm. North Carolina might be number two. And for, you know, Clemson, Florida State, Virginia, Big Ten could go south. They could go north, University of Toronto. I don't know what, maybe they just never know what the Big Ten. All right, that would be
snake, Dan. We should have a snake draft.
Snake draft.
Yeah. A snake draft of the school. If we're creating a third power conference behind the Big Ten and SEC, the schools outside of the Big Ten and SEC, who would we draft into that?
Yeah,
league?
That'd be good. I like All right. That's not bad. Well, that's a good one. Maybe we can do that.
Alaska Fairbanks national champions in rifle, baby.
That's right. They did do that. I don't know. That might be what Trev Alberts is talking about. So mentally prepare yourself for periods of angst. To me, there's nothing going to happen until the ACC busts up, or Notre Dame isn't going to tip until they have to. There's nobody left to take. So, yeah. But it's there. All right, Ross, you
along
report-
those lines. Oh, go ahead. Just real quick. Sorry, but along those lines of the ACC busting up, one of the things some ACC members are furious about is that they believe they would have 11 out of 15 votes to add South Carolina and Cal. They need 12. Florida State is one of the nay votes.
Stanford and Cal.
My
and I know it makes no sense. Like, I think people figured out that they weren't going to add South Carolina, but anything's possible. It's periods of angst.
Don't start rumors, Pat.
I'm so angst-ridden, I can't even talk right.
Alabama to the ACC. Yeah.
Why not?
Start the rumor. Yeah.
Stanford and California, 11 out of 15. They need 12 out of 15. One of the no votes is Florida State. And people are like, look, man, if you're leaving, why should you be the one holding up what the majority of us want? So that's another part of this whole thing. Florida State, Clemson,
North Carolina, North Carolina State. Time,
yeah.
That USC blocked the Pac-12
right.
from expanding, and they leave. I mean, it's a little dirty pool, man. college football playoff. Will the format get shaken up? We have 2024 this year, four teams. Normal, what we've had. 2024, 12 teams, six automatic bids, six at large is what's on the table. That was done when there was a power five. There is now a power four, kind of. It's kind of a power 3.5. I'm not sure what we're calling power. Do we go still go 6-6 for 2 years and then we reinvent this? Do we change? Ross, you did a bunch of reporting on that on Yahoo Sports this week. What do you got?
Well, yeah, one of the ideas of creating the 6+6, which is the six at larges for the six highest ranked teams and six automatic qualifiers for the six highest ranked conference champions. One of the motivations for that was conceivably you would have every power five champion in plus one automatic bid to the highest ranked group of five champion. So, you know, and I think if you did the math for the past 10 years, you would have gotten that except 1 year where the Pac-12 champion wouldn't have made it in actually. And you'd have two group of five champions in. That was just one of the last 10 years. And it was the COVID year, I believe. So now that you have one fewer power leagues, even if the Pac-12 were to like rebuild or something, it wouldn't be a power league, obviously. It would lose A5 status. And most certainly, it would be stripped of its power status when it comes to the CFP, which is very important. You know, people make a big deal out of what is power? You know, what does power conference really mean? Is this just a media-driven thing? No, it's a driven thing by the CFP. It's a revenue distribution difference, between a huge revenue distribution difference. So they won't be a power league by the CFP standards, even if they rebuild. Which means you go back to the formula, right? And you'd have, right now, you'd have, you know, conceivably every, under the 6-6, you'd have every power five champion, all four. And then you'd have two group of, the next two group of five champions. And so you'd have two G5s, which your second G5 that would make the playoff arguably could be outside of the top 25. There are probably years where the second best G5 team, champion team, was outside of the top 25, which nobody probably really wants, except the group of five, probably. But even some of them would agree that this needs to be a debate and a conversation. So the thinking is the easy solution to this is just take away one automatic qualifier and go from 6-5 and add one at large spot, go from 6-7. So a 5+7 instead of 6+6. But there's also the proposal that the SEC threw out there last year, which didn't garner enough support, but it's best 12. Just like we do the top four right now, make the playoff, it would be the top 12. So there are no automatic qualifier spots. I don't think that would have traction outside of maybe three leagues, you know. Certainly the Big Ten and SEC probably would be in favor of that. And that's a whole nother dynamic, right? Like the Big Ten and SEC have gained.
Who's the third?
Well, I mean, I was thinking maybe like either the Big 12 or the ACC might want that. Maybe.
Yeah, that's not thinking forward. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a whole part of this too is the authority and the strength and the power and all that of the Big Ten and the SEC, and how with one fewer power league, those two leagues become a little more powerful. So could they get together and say, hey, we're going to take our ball and go home if we don't do best 12? Yeah, they could, but it takes a unanimity, a unanimous vote, 11-0 or 10-0, if the Pac-12 is no longer exist, I guess, to pass a change in the playoff format for 24 and 25 seasons. 26 and beyond is open, right? There's not even a media contract right now for that. So it'll be fascinating. August 30th, they meet. It was a scheduled meeting to discuss a lot of minutia of the expanded playoff. Now it'll be a discussion of format, and hopefully they can get this done quickly, unlike the last time.
The whole playoff situation has been such an excellent microcosm of college sports as a whole, where these people cannot get along, they cannot see past their own self-interest, and they can't arrive at a consensus to do something that I think on the outside everybody looks at and says, that's good for the sport. That's what, you know, that's why it was such a debacle getting to 12 teams. So now, yes, what are they going to do here? Are they going to go to 5+4, which makes sense? But at the same time, I'm also like, oh, God forbid if two Group of Five champions get in the playoff, that would ruin everything. You know, if we stick with the 6+6, you know, the amount of greed that goes into this, if we've got to have our spots no matter what, and we don't give a damn about anybody else, is a constant reminder of kind of how the sausage is made here.
I do think the third vote could be Notre Dame. I just was thinking of this. True. Notre Dame wants as many at-large bids as possible. A couple things. Pat's correct. Like, this should have been done 10 years ago. I wrote an entire book on how they could do it. They kind of followed it. This, you know, the fact that there was so many people who thought for the moment, and their leagues don't exist or won't exist. If I'm one of these other leagues, so look, I think the right move is to go 7-5. I'm not going to be offended if, okay, a 12, you know, 12-1 Tulane gets in or whatever they were last year. That's great. And all, oh no, it's horrible. We have, you know, 9-3 Boise State makes it or Fresno State. Okay. I don't think that's going to be the end of the world at all. But I do think 7-5 makes sense. But if I'm one of these other leagues, I am not giving the SEC and Big Ten anything.
All right.
I am saying, hell no, we got this agreement. We're going 6-6. Okay. Mm-hmm. Deal with it. Because what are you doing? You could curry favor, supposedly, with these leagues. They don't care. There's no loyalty in this.
No.
I mean, and the SEC and Big Ten could threaten, like, hey, you better vote for the 7-5 ACC, because be ashamed if something happened to Florida State. You know, we'll just, you know, and but they'll take them anyway.
Yeah, that's the thing.
The Big Ten of anybody likes to hold themselves up as the paragons of virtue and a member of the alliance, and we don't want to break up conferences. They you know, and then they break up the conference. So I wouldn't trust any of these guys. You don't know who the commissioner is going to be in 2 years. I think Greg Sankey will still be there, but everybody else seems to be swapping through quick. I'm holding the 6-6. I don't think that's the best format, but I mean, like, what in the world, if you're the Mountain West or the AAC, this is your chance to get an extra, like, grab it. Who the hell knows?
Right. No, if I were the Mountain West, I would be tenaciously fighting to keep 6-6 on the books for 2 years at least, and think we're going to get a chance to get a team in each year. If we do take care of business, if you're from the Sun Belt, this is our chance. If you know, I mean, there's a lot of leagues that I think
look at this. And,
yeah. Toledo, if you have a great season, this is your chance. So that's the thing. Especially given what the SEC and Big 12 or Big 10 have done to choke out the competition, taking schools and already arranging things very much to their advantage. So now you all of a sudden need to roll over and help them more. I wouldn't do it.
Well, and I think most of the Group of Five commissioners think along the lines of we've got to give something, probably. I think there is a tiptoeing around, you know, the Power Five, but specifically the Power Two now. And so I think most of them kind of understand that and understand they, in order to be a part of this, they got to give something, so to speak. And so I think all of them would probably be open to the 5-7 conversation. I think most of them would be closed to the best of 12 conversation. You know, that's kind of how it seems. I mean, we're outside of the Big Ten and SEC, like coming in, getting together, coming in and saying, you know, we're doing best of 12 or in 2026, we're gone or something like that. In spite of that, that happening, I think they do go 5+7. I just don't know how long it takes, because it took 18 months last time. So I'm guessing it'll be shorter this time, since in 18 months we'll be playing the expanded playoff in 24. So hopefully they'll be a little more speedy here. But as I wrote in that story, talking to a few decision makers in the CFP, I said to one, this should be an easy fix. And the person said, easy, nothing is easy with this group. Like, so brace yourselves. There's also the fact that, you know, you've got three things here. You've got format, you've got weighted decision making, And then you've got revenue distribution in the CFP. And I think the SEC, Greg Sankey, has told me that they want all three of those things to change, if not for 24, 25, for 26 and beyond. You know, right now, the revenue distribution, if you don't have the Pac-12, that revenue's got to be redistributed. And the SEC and maybe the Big Ten too, and probably the Big 12, want the distribution based on the number of teams that a league has, the base distribution right now. That's not the case, which, like, for instance, in base distribution last year, Alabama got the same as UCLA, right? Because they're both Power Five and they got the base distribution was the same, even though the SEC had 14 teams, their per school SEC distribution was lower than the Pac-12, which no longer exists. So that was like, that's got to get fixed. I'm sure it will. And then the weighted
Alabama
voting.
Alabama needs a bigger waterfall. Come on. They need a bigger waterfall in Alabama. Come on. Need a bigger waterfall.
Oh, are they shopping at Costco down in Tuscaloosa, clipping coupons? Come on. The size of the league?
Yeah. Well, hey, Dan, you've got the ACC's got 14 members. The Big Ten's got 18 members. That's four more schools. So your average,
that was your dumb ass to keep adding people.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Nobody made them.
Good point. The third part of this is
God, this is petty.
Don't you act shocked, Dan. You act shocked.
I know. This is coming.
We were stupid and we took Rutgers and Maryland. Now you got to pay us for it. Come on. You're already getting all the teams in.
That's
right.
It.
And you do get
everything
a certain amount per team per win.
This
there's a performance based as part of this,
everything.
Too. Ugh. You know, so. And then there's a third bucket, by the way, the weighted voting, which. Each conference gets a certain amount of units. All the Power Five get the same units. The G5 gets less units in the voting. And if you don't have a Pac-12, all those assigned units have to go somewhere. And guess who's going to want them? As one decision maker told me, Big Ten and SEC are going to want those units, and they're going to want it to be a situation where if both of them have to say yes for a decision to be approved. So if even one of them says no, then it doesn't go far. That'll be more of a fight than the format, I think, will be the weighted decision-making in the revenue distribution. Those will be more of an argument in the room, especially for 26 and beyond.
I'm going to go take a shower.
Periods of angst have hit the pod. If when they go to 12, there's two. The top 12 have 10 schools from the SEC and Big Ten in 2024. Like in most years, they're going to get seven. The Big Ten and SEC will combine to get, I would say, 7 to 8 teams into this tournament.
If they just go best 12,
if they just go 5 and 7.
5 and 7, okay, right? Because they would probably get that extra at large, and then they're champions.
They're
going to
get
two
and I'd
each,
say they get
right.
5 of the 7. I'd say 6, 5, 7, maybe. Yeah. The ACC and Big 12 might get a second team, or Notre Dame gets in there. Like, one will get, and maybe Notre Dame. So,
yeah, it's a minimum.
We're talking
6,
your
probably.
Third and fourth place teams are getting into this thing. And we're worried about whether I get an extra share off the Mac because they're just sitting there humbly at 12. Yeah, come on, man. I know. I should expect nothing else, but
Dan,
this is what's going to hold it up. I'm rarely naive and pie in the sky, but
let me be the devil's advocate here. The SEC and Big Ten, well, the SEC has won 13 of the last 17 national football championships, and SEC and Big Ten combined will combine for 34 teams, and probably 8 of the top 10 biggest brands in college football, maybe 12 of the top 15 biggest brands. I'm just saying that is probably their argument.
Their argument is sound, but they're already going to dominate this playoff. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the fourth place.
They've got everything to their advantage. Why stop squeezing for every last ounce?
They want more, more and more and more. They want the gap to grow, and it continues to grow until as we discussed on the show, and as Trev Alberts alluded to, the gap's going to grow to enough where there's going to be a big enough chasm to where we start over in some kind of other situation.
Mentally prepare yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Angst on the way, Dan.
It's funny because for years they we're going to ruin the sanctity of the regular season. This is what ruins the sanctity of the regular season when there's just two conferences.
Yeah, right.
And you come in fourth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one of their.
Sorry, ACC, your regular season doesn't matter.
I don't know. Anyway, they can't go 12. The 12 would be bad, and it'd probably bring lawsuits as it should. But hey, that's what we'll see. We will see, but could be 7-5. We had a homework assignment.
Yes.
Watch the Johnny Manziel Netflix doc. Johnny Football Untold on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, I'll hold thoughts till after these guys, but entertaining. Johnny obviously was a ton of fun to watch. Exciting player. The performance at when they beat Alabama at Alabama was pretty legendary. He's a lot of fun off the field. The social media pictures, him in the Scooby-Doo outfit, him drunk at this bar, him drunk at that bar, him drunk with this blonde, him drunk with that blonde. The characters, Uncle Nate, his business manager, and PR man, Nathan Fitch, great guy, by the way. Great guy. I was glad he was in there. The whole thing. And so they did a show. It's only about 1:20. Again, highly recommend if you haven't seen it. We're going to spoil it. If you don't like it, move forward, you know, whatever.
Spoiler alert.
If you haven't seen it. I don't really know how we spoil the movie.
you're going to be sad at the end.
He doesn't make it with the Browns.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm spoiling. Anyway, Pat, your thoughts on the Johnny Manziel, Johnny Football.
I enjoyed watching it because it did bring back a lot of stuff that I, some of which I remembered, some of which I didn't. But, you know, I mean, he was an incredible player and a wild ride. You know, there was just so much going on with him all the time. And I remember I covered the first game he played. He was a redshirt freshman and he was the starter against Florida. And it was Texas A&M's first game in the SEC. And, I didn't know who he was. I don't think that many people did outside of the state of Texas. And he was good. They kind of glossed over in the movie like, oh, that first game was rough. I mean, I'm sitting there watching it. And I would like to go back and find my live tweets from that game because I was like, this dude can scoot. He can run. He's, you know, he's got a lot of improvisational flair. I had gone with Mike Slive on the SEC jet the night before the game to Florida, to Texas A&M. It was their first game. Slive gets feeded by the, you know, all these big wigs from A&M. And I can't go in the room for the dinner, but I can come in afterwards.
Mm.
The A&M big wigs are sitting around and they're, you know, they're having their glass of wine and their cigar, and they're gonna go to midnight yell practice later, and then the game's at noon. And one of the trustee guys sits there and he said, they've given Slive a pair of boots. And it's sitting there and he said, in 50 years, we will be the controlling brand in the state of Texas. And that's what this was all about for A&M. You know,
we're just
sticking to Texas. Yeah. Hey. Yeah. I mean, nobody thinks that far ahead these days.
Yeah. I mean, God, is the world going to be here?
Yeah. But everybody's like, yeah, sure. Okay. And then you go watch Johnny Manziel the next day and you're like, oh, they might have a quarterback here. And then he's just stock just soared after that, and he had that great season, wins the Heisman Trophy, and he backed it up, and he was damn good in 2013 too. They glossed over the 2013 season. I covered the game against Alabama, the rematch that Alabama won. Manziel was incredible. Threw for 464, ran for 98, 5 passing touchdowns. I mean, he almost won that game by himself. So he was just a great college talent. There's a lot of the story that is disconnected. There's a lot, I think, behind the scenes of who knows who and doesn't, you know, who they wanted to be in the film and who they didn't want to be in the film. But I really enjoyed watching it and just kind of reliving the Johnny Manziel experience, although it doesn't seem to be trending in a great direction.
I enjoyed it. And I only covered, I think, one of his games. I was the LSU beat writer, and I covered the 2013 game at LSU where old defensive coordinator John Chavis had Johnny's number both games, both 12 and 13. I think they were two of his worst games ever. But I enjoyed the doc, and but I was left sad. I mean, at the end of it, it's like, God, it was just, you just come away that with this feeling of sadness for this person who clearly at some point did not like playing football, just did, especially in the NFL. But there were times too in college, it just didn't seem like he wanted to play football. He wanted to do other things aside playing football. Some of them involved Vegas and hotel rooms and powder and liquid and but yeah, it just kind of left me kind of sad, and just, you know, the media attention. One of the scenes is I think it's the Alabama game, after the Alabama game, he walks out of the stadium trying to look for his parents, and he can't find his parents outside of the stadium because of the massive throng of Texas A&M fans who are like trying to kiss him and hug him and get his autograph and all this stuff. And he saw his parents. I think he saw his mom from afar. And his mom in the interview in the documentary said she'll never forget the look in his eyes. It was just this like almost fear. And yeah, it's almost like that's when it started with him, where he went kind of downhill mentally, I guess, from there, and just didn't necessarily love, you know, all the attention, and got to the point where didn't love the game, and it was just sad.
Yeah, I mean, it was, like I said, I thought it was very entertaining. I wish there was more about the Browns. I actually wish this was like a two-part.
Yeah, it could have easily been two or three.
The Browns part, for 2 years of total mayhem, too. They did not do enough time on the Billy Manziel fake, trying to pretend he was Billy Manziel with his fake mustache in Vegas. The sensation, though, was incredible. I remember the second Alabama game. There was a Pat's dropping, like, we're going to have to revisit this wine and cigar party you were at with Mike's Live, plus flying on the SEC. Well, we will revisit that another time. This is not. Did you have to wait outside with like the bus boys or something? What, they wouldn't let you in?
I went and ate a burrito somewhere else, you know, and then came back to campus.
They weren't going to give you a steak. They weren't going to. Can you imagine the size of steak they gave Mike's Live that day?
Bigger than Mike's Live.
Yeah, probably bigger. Yeah, they went up to, what is it, Amarillo, and got that big old thing. Big Tex. Yeah. Anyway, I was at the second, I did not cover the second Alabama game because there was some kind of prize fight. I don't remember if it was UFC or it was like a Manny Pacquiao or something was that night. And I was in Vegas and I was going back. It was during the day, and the lobby of the hotel I was at, it was those hotels off the MGM. And I stop in the lobby. I was in there maybe with someone else to watch the game. And Don Cheadle comes in, the actor Don Cheadle, and sits down next to me and was excited to watch Johnny football.
How about that?
And I just remember being like, now, I mean, he met far cooler people than Don, although Don Cheadle's pretty cool. But, you know, and I think that was like this wild, like they would go to the party and Justin Timberlake is excited to see Johnny football.
Hmm.
Right.
Like, and it's just so rare for a college athlete to connect, not just with like, you know, LeBron's always tweeting at college, like some of those guys are watching, or, you know, Patrick Mahomes is watching college football on Saturday and he might mention, but like just straight A-list Hollywood actors, just big, big time celebrities are excited to watch a college. They all knew Johnny football. And I just remember being like, okay, this is odd. But, He was like, oh, yeah, how's it going? What's Johnny doing? Like, that's what he said. Like, he's just this guy walking in the bar. And you're like, wow, I don't know how many football players. He might be huge college football. I don't know. But it was just like, I was like, wow, he's there for the fight, right? Celebrities go to fights. Here they were talking. So it was so big. Yeah, I wish there was more in the Browns. It definitely glossed over certain things. the Johnny's pretty forthcoming. It was entertaining. It was also sad. To me, the story is in its second act. And like, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, at the end of the thing, he's sitting at a party drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's got like these other dudes in Scottsdale. He's like, oh, I'm in Scottsdale just hanging out.
He's throwing darts not exactly. By a pool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not exactly a mountain retreat of a monastery somewhere where I'm just meditating.
Yeah.
Like, oh, great. And there's like these dudes there. He's throwing darts, drinking during the day. And you're like, oh, boy. Like, this is sad. But he had way too much drug and alcohol problem. I don't think the crowds did it to him. I think he was. Because he partied the whole time. I mean, Cliff Kingsbury is like, he's basically hung over at a walkthrough and he's like, you better play good tomorrow. Like, A&M didn't care, you know.
Well, that was one of the reasons I would have liked an interview with Kevin Sumlin and or the athletic director at the time. I'm not even sure who it was. Like, did y'all have rules? was there rules for everybody and then no rules for Johnny? Because Johnny didn't seem to really be constrained by much of anything, including the excellent detail about the fourth string QB passing his urine test for him for the drug test.
So whoever that, his phone must have blown up.
You know about that? This was interesting. I just happened to listen to an episode of the Levitard podcast and they had Johnny Manziel on and they asked Johnny about the drug test. And he said that was the one thing in the documentary that was inaccurate.
Oh, really?
Believe what you want, but he kind of went off on how that was inaccurate. That was never the case.
Burkhart made that up.
But I don't know. Johnny did not refute it on the doc. They showed a little clip of him kind of smirking. You know.
Yeah, he did not about it. Yep. Yeah.
Of all, I will give it may not be true because Johnny admits to doing like Oxy every day.
Everything. Yeah. It would make sense that he would get somebody to then do a drug test for him.
Yeah, that was after. I mean, he pretty much admits to everything. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple of the things that I was kind of wanting a little more from. I would like Kevin Sumlin. Where is he? Why wasn't he interviewed in this? Cliff Kingsbury, who coached Johnny as an assistant for 1 year, is interviewed, not Kevin Sumlin. No teammates were interviewed. I would have liked to have heard what they thought of playing with Johnny, both college and pro. Some thoughts there. So those were a couple of things. And then, these relationships, like, to Dan's point of, like, where, first of all, one word that never came up from Johnny that I heard was sobriety. And so that's kind of still seems like an elusive thing out there. Who are these guys he's hanging out with, and what is he doing every day?
Like, yeah, they didn't.
Do we have any explanation?
Does he have a job? Like they didn't finish the doc with the typical, like, here's what's happening now, except some flashes of him living, I think, with his dad and then hanging out by the pool, throwing darts and drinking beer with buddies. It's very weird.
Yeah. In Scottsdale, not where it's his dad. Yeah. Is his dad still in Kerrville? Yeah. I would have been fine if that was multi-part. Like I was wanting more. Yeah. My feeling is this is the first Johnny Manziel doc, and anyway, highly entertaining. I think everyone who listens to this show will enjoy that on Netflix. So go give it a shot. Also funny is that Heisman finalist Johnny Manziel and then Manti Te'o who had his own doc.
Oh, yeah. His own Netflix doc, right? Same thing.
Johnny is probably drunk and high at the Heisman ceremony. Manti is panicked because he's about to get outed as being catfished. Right. Colin Klein, you well-adjusted young man. What are you doing? The other finalist, is like, I almost won. Like, wasn't there like the Miss America got banned and they had to give it to the runner-up or something?
Colin Klein
could have fallen to Colin. He's still got a chance.
The wholesome, normal Heisman finalist who actually was just an okay player. Certainly no NFL future for him.
No, but hey, he wasn't, you know, as things, whatever was going on in Colin's life, it was nothing compared to these guys. He must have been exactly. Like, these dudes are nervous, man. They are nervous. One's twitchy from the coke. The other twitchy from his girlfriend Lene died Kokoa. And then was reincarnated. I just want to get back to Kansas. What is going on? Oh, yeah, that's a riot. Great Heisman ceremony, folks. Good job. All right. We have one more Hollywood and college football. You want a sequel? How about Blindside 2? This could get interesting.
Blindsided.
Yes.
Blindside 2 is going to get ugly. As the heartwarming and inspirational tale of Blindside 1, where a wealthy suburban Memphis couple bring in a disadvantaged but highly talented young inner city youth, put him up in their house and turn him into a Super Bowl champion, turns out to be maybe not so true. Or maybe it's not all hunky-dory. They didn't all live happily ever after. Let's put it that way. Michael Orr has sued the Tui family, Sean and Leanne Tui, claiming that they never adopted him. They simply put him in a conservatorship, but then sold the story of the adoption and then set up a deal with 20th Century Fox for the Blindside movie, which where they got 2.5% of some portion of revenue and I think $250,000 up front, and then shared it with their two birth children who are in the movie and not him. And then, of course, the movie has, you know, Sandra Bullock and starring turns by Coach O, Nick Saban, all sorts of guys are in there. It's pretty good. And makes, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, the Tuis have responded vehemently saying this is garbage. They have proof. They can show the contracts that show they never did. They never any money they shared equally with all the family members. And Michael has tried in the past to do this. They called it a shakedown. And other lawyers wouldn't take the case and all that, and they're humiliated and all that. We'll see who's right and wrong. I don't think any of us are in a position to say who's right, who's wrong. The interesting part is, indeed, they never adopted him, and the Tui said they had to put him in a conservatorship so that the NCAA would let him play at Ole Miss. Michael was 18 before he ever moved into their house. One thing I can say that is not true in the movie, they did not find him like standing in the rain. That was always not true. It's Hollywood, right? But people take this stuff like deathly seriously. He was not just wandering the streets of Memphis. He was already enrolled at that Tony little private school they had. What is it? Yeah. Blairwood or Blair?
Briarcrest or something.
Briarcrest. Right. Hugh Freeze is the head coach. Yeah. You think Hugh didn't know there was a kid wandering around and got him on the team?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So he was already in the school. He often lived with teammates and classmates who would crash at their houses. And it wasn't until after, and he was an all-state player as a junior. He was not this unknown recruit that needed Sandra Bullock to teach him pad level at practice. That was always the worst part. I think Hugh Freeze is letting Sandra Bullock hang out at the practice. Although maybe Sandra Bullock wants to come.
Yeah.
I mean, I
guess, a little bit of a distraction for the players, no?
Well, you know, Hugh's been distracted before, and this is Sandra Bullock. She can come hang out and work any of our works, I'm sure. Anyway, back to the topic. He was already, so they took him in the senior year, the summer before his senior year, when he was already a big recruit. And he lived, and look, they put him in the house, and they got the SAT tutors and all that. You know, were they just helping somebody out? If so, that's a Hollywood movie. Were they doing it because they wanted the kid to go to Ole Miss? That's what the NCAA alleged. And in the movie, they make the NCAA and their investigator, who they name by name in that movie, out to be like this horrible villain. How could you suggest there was anything untoward about this wonderful relationship? And I always thought that was a little unfair, because if you knew the actual timeline, you'd be like, wait a minute, you just happened, the one kid you decided to bring in happens to be... Yeah. A star player, and they just happen to go to your football program. So that's some of the stuff. Anyway, thoughts on the Blindside 2. I don't know where we're going. It's going to be a legal thriller, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty jarring twist to it all. That's for sure. And I don't know who's lying. I don't know who's telling the truth. It's probably somewhere in the middle with all of this. There's probably some amount of blame or culpability to go around, you know, as you certainly pointed out, Dan, that Hollywood likes to put things in tidy boxes with nice bows on them, and that's probably not the case here as far as who was being opportunistic, who wasn't, and who was telling the truth about things and who wasn't. The one thing I will say, you know, I Michael Oher is now 37 years old. You know, I hope this isn't strictly just a money play for a guy who mismanaged a seven-year NFL career in terms of getting paid. He's a first-round pick. Again, seven seasons in the NFL, so he should have a considerable amount of money.
I think he made just under $40 million, but
yeah,
I don't know if he blew it. People are saying that, but like, listen, we're just talked about the SEC and the Big Ten saying we want more. They ain't broke.
Yeah. True.
Very Everybody true. Wants their cut, right?
Yep. Yep.
So
yep.
So I don't know.
I don't know, but you know, it's a good. I don't know whether it's good, but it's a bit of a jarring pullback of the curtain on the way some things are packaged and presented. I'd kind of like to hear from Michael Lewis, who wrote the book.
He's only part of the book is this, because he knew the Tuohys.
Yeah.
And then people would buy that book. They watch the movie, they buy the book, and then they'd get very disappointed that most of the book was about, like, offensive linemen.
Right, right. Yeah.
But
the Michael lead Lewis is about Lawrence Taylor breaking Joe Theismann's leg.
Yeah, right. It's all about
why you need left tackles. Yeah.
Yeah. Lewis obviously wrote The Big Short, you know, a ton of great writer. But yeah, I don't know.
The Ross, money situation's, yeah, interesting to me. And so I think it was in like stories I read, including your column, Dan. So they were promised 2.5% in royalties.
And maybe which
came to like $7 or $8 million. And then they signed for $1 million, the family, right? Like $250,000 each. But then, yeah, there's some contention that they say that that's not true.
That's what Orr says. They say no. The dad told the Daily Memphian that they each got $14,000. I will say, if I was going to make the cuts here, again, this is very SEC Big Ten. I'm not sure that pie shouldn't have been 50% Tuohy family, 50% Big Mike.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks for coming, like, older teenage daughter, but you really were a bit player in the movie.
Yeah, the kids like, each got $250,000, allegedly, right?
Well, yeah, allegedly. Now, SJ was on Barstool Radio. He claimed over the years he's made about 60 or 70 in royalties. So I don't. There are no facts right now. That's why I don't want to say.
Yeah.
I mean, people went crazy and they're like, the Tuohys are the worst. And it's like, you don't, hold on, man. You can say anything in a lawsuit. I always like, hold up.
Yeah.
Hold up. So I don't know. I don't know, but it's not good. And it's unfortunate because it really was good. Would you watch the movie again?
Well, now I think I'd watch it with a jaundiced eye and be like, I don't know about that. You know,
I'd watch Blindsided.
Blindsided. Yes. It's going to be, this could be the next Netflix doc. Yeah. Blindside 2. There is a great, I don't know if it's a Saturday Night Live skit or whatever, where the Leanne Tuohy, they use the footage from the movie to, and she kidnaps Peyton Manning and makes him stay in the house. It's really funny if you look it up. And Peyton has to go along or he's going to get killed. It's very good. Which leads me to my Peyton Manning thing. He is going to be a professor.
Oh, yeah.
The sheriff is now a professor. He is joining the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's College of Communication and Information faculty. He's going to give some different lectures. Now, obviously, great football player, but his Omaha Productions, he's deep in the media. I would like to take this class.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, he's more successful at this than me. Also football, he's better. I'm acting, all the different stuff. But pretty interesting. He's going to teach classes, not teach, but like lecture. I don't know. Eli has weighed in and said it is an easy A and encourages everyone to take it. Ross, will Peyton Manning be an easy grader?
No. No, he doesn't seem like he'd be an easy grader at all. He seems like he'd be a stickler, especially for like details and penmanship even and all that stuff, man. I wouldn't want Peyton. Eli seems like he'd be a little more carefree. You know, that looks like more of the easy A. And then Cooper, you could probably just fly right through all his classes.
He would do the outdoor lectures on nice days, right?
Yeah. And like afterwards, hey, I'm going to go over and across the street and get a beer. Who wants to come?
The
with
local
me?
Bar yeah. is go, open. Yes.
Go drink
yes.
with yeah. the professor. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I agree. Peyton gets after those QBs on the Manning cast if they like, there's a check down. It's, you know, right?
Oh, yeah.
Pat, would you take, what do you think? Easy grade?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. No. I see Peyton up there at the, at the in the you know, in the lecture hall, looking up at the students, and he's like reading a defense. Row 13, seat 11, sit up straight. Row 4, seat 3, you're not paying attention. I need you to be taking notes. Let's go. You came in 1.5 minutes late. You're going to run tremendous. After class.
Yeah. Pointing, yeah. Omaha.
Yeah.
All right, I'm deep now in the depths of these NIL vodka and beer. Funniest thing in college sports history, maybe, is that the athletic departments are now just trying to get everyone wasted under the auspices of recruiting. They use recruiting to do everything, and now everyone's got a vodka, everyone's got a whiskey, everyone's got beer, right? So I've been praising various ones. I think West Virginia is going to be hard to beat. I'm not getting into all. I see you, Cincy Light. Like, until stuff starts showing up on my doorstep, you know, you're off the list, though. I'm just saying.
Exactly. You've opened up Pandora's box here.
Yeah, well, I might as well open up some beers on the weekend if I'm going to start hyping all you guys. But I will do this one. So far, the best NIL beer I have seen comes from Kansas State and the Manhattan Brewing Company, which has the Tang Party. Jerome Tang, Coach Tang, has his own beer, the Tang Party. It is tangerine cascade dry hopped sour. That's how it's described.
Wow.
Jerome Tang, the Tang Party. That I want the coaches in on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I would try a Tang Party. I'm not a big sour drinker, but I'd try that.
What would Saban's beer taste like? Harbaugh would have a milk flavor. I think Harbaugh would be a stout, kind of milky, go well with a steak.
For sure.
Yeah. Right. Now, Saban's would taste like intensity, Dan.
What does he eat every day? He eats the, is it not, Twinkies? What is it? Little Debbie's?
Little Debbie's. Yeah.
Yeah. Little Debbie flavored beer.
Ugh.
What coach's beer would be the best? That'd be really
Sam
late.
Pittman. Like, although Sam Pittman said he would drink a ham, so I don't know.
That's say Sam Pittman's be good.
Coach O, straight Red Bull and vodka.
Bull and vodka, yeah.
RBVB.
I feel like Lane doesn't drink beer. He goes for the harder stuff than that. Mm,
yeah.
You know, I would say like Kyle Whittingham. He's in Utah. They got good beers there. He looks like he'd sit
he's
back.
Mormon. And... He's Mormon.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Never mind.
Hey, if it helps recruiting, he's going to have a beer. Like, look, man, it's the only way you're winning the Big Ten. You're in the Big 12 now. West Virginia is drinking their ass off and beating you on recruits. I know your religious beliefs, coach. No, I don't know. I don't know. We might need to do more work on that.
We got to think about this a little bit here.
Yeah. That's... All right. We'll work on it. Additional alcohol news. This is quite a thing. Mm. Eggo waffles. We all know Eggo waffles. Staple of the rushed breakfast.
Lego my Eggo.
Lego my Eggo. It is teamed up with the Sugarlands Distilling Company. And they are launching Eggo Brunch in a Jar sipping cream.
Mm.
What?
It is a liqueur that seamlessly blends the flavor of toasted Eggo waffles, sweet maple syrup, rich butter, and a hint of smoky bacon. So there is alcohol in this thing. It's like a cream deal. They even have a picture of a nice little put it in a nice glass, and you have a little small Eggo minis, and then a piece of bacon in there.
Wow.
Is this the
only 850 calories?
Is this the end of America? Is this the end of America? We're now drinking through our egos,
drinking brunch,
which already was bad for us.
Yeah. Sounds like an absolute catastrophe of mashed up artificial flavors there. I would defer to Ross. Ross is a little more of a liquor guy than I'm more of a beer guy. So I would defer to him on the ego liqueur.
Yeah. This sounds like a lot. Is it thick? I wonder how thick it is. I wonder if the consistency.
Yeah, it's got a cream.
Oh man. So it's like a milkshake. It sounds like a Lego milkshake, which could be good, I guess.
Ego flavor, ego bacon and maple syrup egg milkshake kind of thing with booze in it.
I mean, it's probably taste good. I don't know that I could choke down a whole one, huh? I mean, God.
What do you do when you're you know, these 9 a.m. kickoffs, they're going to have some of these West Coast teams.
That's true.
Oh, you're saying turn to the Lego brunch shake?
I think this could be a tailgate thing.
Get ready, West Coast fans. Yeah, when you're getting up to see the Washington Huskies play the Maryland Terrapins at 9 a.m.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Enjoy your Lego ego.
Something to take the edge off. Anyway, that's right. Also,
I'd rather Eggos on the plate, I think.
Yeah. I mean, two great tastes that go great together. I don't know. Anyway, weekends only. Please do not start doing the Eggo brunch in a jar before work and driving to work. It just seems it's a dangerous combo.
Mm-hmm.
I also learned, pod listener Todd Jones told me that he recently rode on the Goodyear blimp. He works at Ohio State.
He did.
He rode on the Goodyear blimp, and to add to the spying possibilities, both of his pilots were Ohio State alums.
Last
week we raised the does Ohio State use the Goodyear blimp to spy on other opposing teams practices, and they are so add that to the plot.
We need to open records request the phone logs to see who's been in communication from the Ohio State Athletic Department to the blimp.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to do that. Freedom of Information Act. Let's get on that. Oh, yeah. Get cracking on that. So there you go. So that's an ongoing saga. Beware the blimp. The blimp also tweeted us.
Ah, yeah. Yeah,
that was an honor.
It really was.
Blimp is to the pod. About that.
Imagine telling like yourself like 20, the Goodyear blimp will one day tweet you and you'll be like, what does that sentence mean? So appreciate
you'll be publicly acknowledged by someone pretending to be the blimp.
The blimp. Thanks, blimp, for listening. We appreciate it. Obviously they got a lot. That blimp doesn't move that fast. They got a lot of time to listen. They're going to games. I can see it. Play us up there on the blimp. We appreciate it. All right, that's it. Blimp and everybody else, please leave us nice reviews. Continue to subscribe. Tell your friends about us. And next week, week zero.
Whoa.
Minutemen at it's Aggies. Here. The Battle of Las Cruces. We got a lot going on. No, Caleb Williams will be in action. Navy and Notre Dame. There's a lot going on. Next week is week zero. We have almost made it. We have almost made it. We'll see if we do. Appreciate everybody, and we'll talk to you later.